Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 25th, 1999. In the Koinonia Fireside Room this morning is Paul Palumbo, and his session number is 99-3, and is entitled Daughters of the Kingdom. Continuing his Bible study this week, let's listen in.
Well, welcome. Today we're going to be looking at the Gospel of Mark. And we're going to look at one story, which is actually, it's a two-for-one bargain, because there's two stories, actually, that are put together by Mark. Come on in. So before we do that, let's take a moment. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us pray. Gracious God, by your Spirit, you bring healing and wholeness. By your Spirit, you gather a community together. We pray, O Lord, that as you gather us together, your healing power will be among us. Lead us in this study and guide us in your ways. Amen. Okay, we've got the story of the raising of Jairus' daughter and the woman with the flow of blood. Did you get a chance to read it? I'm sorry?
Very quickly.
Very quickly. Well, what we have here in this story is a classic Markan sandwich. A story that begins, and then another story that sort of interrupts the story, and then the ending of the first story. We call that a Markan sandwich. And I don't know why we call it a Markan sandwich, except that, you know, it sandwiches two stories together. And I also think that Mark invented this thing, you know. It doesn't happen very often, but in Mark it happens all the time. So when, for example, Jesus is sending out the disciples in their first missionary attempt, he sends out the 12, and then he sandwiches in there a story about the death of John the Baptizer, and then he comes back and reports that the disciples come back to Jesus. Okay, and the idea is you're supposed to read the two stories together. They are commentary on each other. And so what might the commentary be, for example, on Jesus sending out the 12 and then reporting on the story of John the Baptizer and his death? Any connection? It's a dangerous business out there. That's what the connection might be. Huh? You know, if you're going to proclaim what God says to proclaim, you could be in trouble too, just like John. And let me tell you about John. And off it goes. Another classic Markan sandwich is the cursing of the fig tree. Jesus goes and he curses that fig tree because there weren't any figs on it. Remember that? And then, right after that, he goes into the temple and he curses the temple. Then he comes back. And the next day it's reported that the disciples see that the fig tree had withered and died. A powerful commentary that the temple religion was dying. This is a story that we've got here is also a story. It's a sandwich story. And these two stories are meant to be read together. I wish we could have put them like this, but we'll just do it verbally. Is there somebody who would like to read this story for us? From 21 to 43.
Okay. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue named Jairus came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So he went with him. And a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She'd endured much under many positions and had spent all what she had. And she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. For she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha cum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat.
Okay. So you can see the two stories, right? And he's on his way. He's on his way to Jairus' daughter's to take care of that story. And this woman comes up, touches him. And then there's another story about her. And then off it goes back to Jairus, right? And they're connected. Having heard the story, can you tell me some of the parallels between the two stories? Some points of contact, maybe. Let's look at those.
Well, the 12 years.
What, 12 years?
Well, the hemorrhage had been going on for 12 years, and the daughter was 12 years old.
Ah, right. Okay. So the hemorrhage is 12 years, and the daughter is 12 years old. There's a connection.
Seeking out Jesus. They both seek out Jesus.
Both?
The servant and the woman.
Right, Jairus.
They're probably both expecting the same results. Yeah.
Okay, good. Another point of contact. Anything else?
They both didn't really want to bother him.
They both didn't want to bother him.
Yeah.
Okay.
After the initial, they said, "Don't bother the teacher. She's already dead." And
right.
The lady in the crowd just wanted to sneak up and touch his garment and address him.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah, great. Exactly.
Also, there's belief involved in both.
Belief? Did you say belief?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Daughter, your faith has made you well, and I can find your Jairus only belief.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Exactly.
Not always the case. He doesn't always say that.
Right.
I always think it's a story of great persistence, too.
Persistence.
Both parties.
Yes. Okay. Great. Fear is a contact point for both. She's in fear and trembling. She goes and prostrates herself before him. And when the message comes, Jesus says, "Do not fear, but believe." So there's another point. How about the fact of daughters? Huh? The girl is obviously the daughter of Jairus. But what about the woman who comes to touch Jesus?
He calls her daughter.
He calls her daughter. All right. Now, this is I think one of the most radical things that happens in the whole story. Here's this woman, she's got a flow of blood for 12 years, which makes her ritually unclean. So she's been sort of on the outside for that. What else is wrong with her? Well, she's a woman. All right? And that, in her society, there's a problem, right? What else? She spent all her money on doctors. I mean, she could have been living today, right? It's a very contemporary problem, is what I'm saying.
Managed care would have cut her off a long time.
Oh, yeah. The story could just very well read. She got cut off from her managed care provider, and yeah, sure. So she's poor because she spent all her money on doctors, and she's not any better. She's worse. That could work too. Okay, so she's got all these strikes against her, and she comes up. So she is on the periphery, at the very most. She's way out there. Okay, if you think of the purity code and the purity cult, then you have to think from the inside, like a circle. And the inside, the very holy of holies, right? And only the high priest of that year can go in there. And then you've got the outer courts, and the further away you go from that place, the further away you are from God, the further removed you are from the whole of the religious life. Okay? This woman is way out there. Okay? And so when she comes and touches Jesus, a couple of things happen. First of all, if you're ritually unclean, you shouldn't go around touching people, because that makes them ritually unclean. Your uncleanliness is contagious. That's why you don't touch dead bodies. You know, you don't touch blood. If you do that, then you got to go through this whole process of purification. Okay? Well, here's this woman, and she's got a flow of blood, and for 12 years she's had this. She should know better. And yet she goes up and she touches Jesus. And I think the part about touching his clothes may just be, I won't touch him, I'll just touch his clothes. And so she does that. And when she does that, she becomes healed. And Jesus stops the whole parade, right? There's this whole entourage going to Jairus' house, and people are bumping him to and fro. He stops and he says, "Who touched me?" And the disciples go, "Who touched you? Who hasn't touched you? What are you talking about? Everybody's touching you. They all want to touch you." Somebody touched me. And that's when the woman comes with fear and trembling and lays down at his feet. And then he says, "Daughter." This is an adoption. Huh? This woman who was outside gets adopted back in. Daughter. And that's the only name she gets. She doesn't have a name in the story. This is the only title that she's given in this text, and it's enough. Jesus adopts her as a daughter. Now, Jairus' daughter, she's already a daughter, right? That's already been proclaimed. That's already her title. But not this woman. Because we've got a story of two different daughters from very different social locations, right? Jairus is a leader of the synagogue. His daughter is over here and probably up here. And this woman is way down here and way out. Now, yes?
I noticed that she knew she'd been healed as soon as she touched the cloak.
Mm-hmm.
And Christ tells her again, "Be healed of your disease."
Right.
But she already knew she was healed.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he wasn't saying, he wasn't healing her over again.
Acknowledging.
It's like, go be in your wellness.
Ah.
Yeah? Go exist in this. Huh?
Be reconciled. Go back and be a part.
Yes. That as well. Yeah. The whole business of healing is never, in the Gospel of Mark, healing is never just about physical stuff. Jesus isn't just a doctor. Nor would they have that idea even that it's just physical, but it's religious, it's spiritual, and it's communal. So a woman who is outside of the community is in need of healing.
So there was more
back into
to it.
More to it than just the stop of a flow of blood. Like, yes, absolutely.
Well, yeah. He didn't rescind it either.
I'm sorry?
He didn't rescind the touching. He said, yeah, that's okay that you did it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, he doesn't say, hey, wait a minute. You know, now I got to go be now I'm ritually impure. He doesn't say that at all. And in fact, where's my Orthodox friend? Is she here? Ah, all right. The way the Orthodox understand the baptism of Jesus, we have this great, we scratch our heads and we say, why did Jesus have to be baptized if this is for remission of sin? Well, the Orthodox simply say, when Jesus was baptized, he cleansed water. And now we can go and baptize people and cleanse them with the pure water that Christ has cleansed. Isn't that interesting? Is that not right?
Yeah, but I have another question.
Oh, another question. Okay.
When he says daughter, I don't know if anybody knows this, but is he referring to daughter of Israel as in son of Israel, or is he referring to, would a rabbi speak to people as son and daughter, or would this be pointing to the fact that he is God and that father-daughter, traditional father-daughter kind of relationship exists? Now, I know has anybody ever looked at it that way? Probably not.
I think yes to all three. That it is certainly a restoration as a daughter of Israel. Okay, that much I think absolutely. A rabbi could talk to a person that way, and a daughter of God. I think all three. Yeah, which is absolutely delightful, isn't it? I mean, it's amazing. This woman who, for 12 years, has been on the outs. It's an incredible restoration. Oh yeah, and by the way, she gets healthy too. But that restoration back into the community is just—it's amazing. Yeah.
About healing, there's at least three words. Years ago, I did a word study on healing, and one of them involves therapeuo, from therapeutics, which is really sort of the healing art that we think of doctors doing. The second one migrates through the words to salvus, which is the root word of salvation, which is to make whole, to make complete. And the third one is sort of another, be perfect as I am perfect, or be whole. Mm-hmm. So when he says be healed, he's telling her you're saved and you are made whole.
Right.
So not only are you therapeuo, healed of your hemorrhage.
Right. Exactly. And I think, and then this one is the salvo, I think. From which we get salvation, right? Yeah. So, where am I? Oh yeah. Okay. So Jesus has gone to. She touches him, and. Oh yeah, I wanted to also say that there's this incredible business about Jesus and a reverse contagion. Happens all the time. That people who are unclean or sick touch him, and instead of him getting sick or him getting unclean, they get well, they get clean. So health, wellness, wholeness in Jesus is contagious. Okay? And that's kind of a nice image to keep in mind when you're reading, and you see things about lepers, and you see things about the sick. Remember that whenever people touch Jesus, or whenever Jesus is around, it's his wholeness that's contagious, not their illness. Okay? Or not their uncleanliness. Which totally destroys the whole purity thing. And in the Gospel of Mark, that's precisely what Jesus is trying to do. The Gospel starts with Jesus out, well, starts actually with John out in the wilderness. And then it's a whole series. It's like a march into the inner circle. And every time he comes to a circle with a barrier, Jesus just kind of knocks it down. Let's go to the next barrier, knocks it down, goes to the next, until he gets right into Jerusalem and right into the heart of the temple and knocks that down too. And of course, he gets killed for it. But he's always, it's always that his wellness flows out to other people. All right? And this is another example. This woman who has no business touching him, has no business being well, is made well. And he has no business really stopping what he's doing in order to make her well, does he? I mean, he's got an important task. Jairus, a leader of the synagogue, has come to him, has bowed down to him, paid him homage, in order that he will come and take care of Jairus' daughter. Now, he's on his way to do this, and he stops for this outcast woman. Now, if you're Jairus, what are you thinking? Huh?
Take care of my daughter.
Come on, let's get this party going, right? Keep the momentum going towards my house. Of course. What's up with her?
In the interim, his daughter dies.
And it, right, not only that, then the word comes, your daughter's dead. Yeah. And we're struck with that too. I mean, here's a kid, you know? Man. You think that Jesus would take care of kids?
He opened himself on the way to Lazarus too, so certainly points out that we should be willing to be interrupted and not just be so task-oriented that we don't see anything in ourselves.
Yeah. Boy, Jesus just has this crazy notion that he should live right where he's at. I don't know where he gets that. I have a friend who does that, and he drives me absolutely nuts. He's one of my best friends. I love him dearly, but I tell you, he can't keep an appointment to save his life. He has this great capacity to be where he is. Therefore, if he's on his way to meet you, and somebody has a flat tire, well, he's going to stop and help them change their flat tire or get their car going, however way. And then, if they have an emotional crisis, well, he's going to listen to their story about that too. And then he's going to get to you, maybe an hour and a half late. And if you're his friend, you wait for him. And otherwise, you know, he loses friends that way.
And you get to hear some neat stories of what he's been doing.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the best. Some of the best stories.
You'll never guess what happened on the way here today.
Yeah, right. Well, he doesn't even say that. He comes in and apologizes. Well, I'm sorry, you know, well, there was a dog on the side of the road and he had a broken leg and I had to take him to the vets and then the vets said I'm sorry. But he's just right. He's always in the present. And for he to me, this story reminds me of my friend Warren. Jesus is that way. And so he stops the whole process and he's checking around and this daughter, he claims another daughter as a result. And then the report comes: Jairus' daughter's dead. Jesus says, "Don't fear, but believe." Well, if I'm Jairus, I'm thinking, yeah, sure. But off they go, and then they go into the house, and when he gets there, all the people are wailing and weeping and all that. And Jesus asks them courteously to leave. Except that's not what he does. He throws them out. That's how it should be translated. He casts them out. And then he takes Peter, James, and John and the parents. He goes up to the daughter and tells the daughter, Talitha kum, get up. Little girl, get up. And she gets up and walks around. Mark says, because she's 12 years old. And then Jesus says, now, get her something to eat. You know, being dead takes a lot out of you. You know, you need some energy. Eat.
Then he also tells them to tell no one.
And then he says,
how could you ever keep that?
Well, yeah. You know, when everybody's been dead, there's a morning, and then they're going to see her run around.
Yeah.
Don't tell anybody.
Right. What do you make of that? It's pretty weird, isn't it?
Besides which, somebody read it, because the story came up.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Well, how about this? There's obviously we can contrast the two stories. The woman comes and is healed, and it's this very public event. And Jesus doesn't tell her, don't go tell anybody. She says, go in peace, your faith has made you well, right? And then there's this other with the rich man, with the powerful man, I should say. I don't know whether he's rich, but he's powerful. And this private, and he says, don't tell anybody. What about this? In one instance, the woman who was outcast has been restored, and that's something that everybody needs to know about. Okay. In this case, he's, don't tell anybody, i.e., don't use this for more power.
Was she actually dead?
Dead.
Yeah, misjudgment.
No, dead. Dead as a doornail. Yep. She's dead. And everybody knows it. He comes in and says, oh, she's not dead, she's asleep. And they laugh at him because they've seen dead. They know dead. Right? And he goes in and raises her from the dead. Yeah. Pretty shocking, huh? Yeah. So there's this, it seems to me that Jesus is, the proclamation of the kingdom is about balancing this thing out, okay? Both daughters are healed, right? However, this daughter down here takes precedent because Jesus stops and takes care of this woman, all right? And then restores her publicly. And it's as if he's proclaiming this woman, this daughter, is back among us. Is back in, okay, among the people of God. She is not cast out as she was. This person never was cast out. And there's no reason to proclaim that she's back in. So keep it to yourself. Because you probably will tend to want to use that in some way. You know, people with power want more power, maybe. Right? And so the kingdom goes like this. Okay? And there's this equilibrium going. Does that make sense? Are we...
But why did he bring Peter, James, and John with him? He should have brought someone else.
You know, yes, that's what I was going to say. I think that Peter, James, and John go on all of the important things that happen. You know, the transfiguration, it's Peter, James, and John. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Peter, James, and John. Here, Peter, James, and John. And it's wasted on them. They never get it in Mark's gospel. Now, Matthew and Luke are a little different. But in Mark, they just don't understand. James and John, Jesus will say, whoever gains their life will lose it, whoever loses their life will gain it. Okay? And then James and John will come up to Jesus, you know, and say, hey, listen, we want you to do for us something. And Jesus says, well, what is it? We want you to give us a place at your right and your left hand and your glory. You know, come on, come on. Weren't you listening? Don't you know that I'm going to Jerusalem to die? And you want to be on my right and my left for that? They never get it. So I don't know why Peter, James, and John. They're always at important places, but in Mark, they don't get it.
Would it be as a possible witness to what he has done, the power that Jesus had after Jesus was crucified?
Mm-hmm.
So that he has someone, yes, I was there, I saw it, to the crowds who may not have witnessed.
Yeah,
reason?
Could be, could well be, yeah. It seems to me should have picked more credible witnesses, or at least more witnesses who would actually listen and see, you know. Well, he gets that way finally, but in Mark he doesn't. In Mark he just never does. He never comes around. Well, he does. Yeah, there's Pentecost. You know, there's always hope. That's my hope. You know, Peter, James, and John, they don't get it. They didn't get it either. And then the Spirit came, and then they got it. And so there's hope for all of us.
But maybe that's what makes them more credible witnesses afterwards. I mean, maybe if they'd gotten it all along, you know, regular people might think, well, you know, this is just far beyond me. But if it's Peter, James, and John, you know, and Peter's constantly stumbling along. They're like, well, if Peter can, then shucks anybody.
That's it. That's it. Yep. I think that's exactly the spirit of Mark's gospel. Yeah, definitely. Yes?
Could it be the reason he said go and tell no one is that he didn't want them to place their emphasis of hearing and healing those that were already believers but spend more time on, you know, the unbelievers?
Well, yeah, you know, that's a possibility because you think of the story of he goes to Gennesaret and the guy who's living in among the tombs, who's been has all those demons, the legions of demons. He casts them out, and that guy wants to follow him. Is that this right story? And then he says no, but go and tell everyone what God has done for you. And that's among non-believers. Okay, so yeah, that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. Could well be.
And doesn't he want to really say that his mission is to the disenfranchised and the downtrodden and the poor and the sick, and not to the head of the synagogue and the powerful? There's a tendency for people to believe, well, Jesus is here for us, the powerful one.
Right.
He hobnobs with us, and it makes the disenfranchised people just reinforce their sense of not being included. And he's trying to reverse that in that same balancing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's a contrast here between the daughter, the woman, and the parents of the child, in that the woman had faith that if she touched him, she would be healed.
Uh-huh.
The parents and the crowd that were there were already crying and wailing and had lost faith. And through this, they would regain their faith.
Huh.
The words, I was just going to echo exactly what you're saying, and the words are from, he says to the unclean woman, your faith has made you well.
Right.
And he says to Jairus, do not fear, only believe. He has to remind Jairus to believe.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, good. Uh-huh. And so that Yeah. Oh, good. That's great. I like that. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
People have used this now, though, for those who are ill and don't get well, that there must be something wrong with your faith.
Yeah.
Heard people struggle with that. Why
aren't I getting
well?
That's a real dangerous message, I think. Yeah. And there are times when people are made well and there's no mention of faith whatsoever. Simply the power of Jesus to heal. Yeah. So, yeah. And we have to be careful. I think we have to be really careful about that one. Because even when we're not meaning that, a lot of times we say things that imply that. And that's a struggle. Yeah.
A lot of questions we can't answer.
Yep. Absolutely. Yes.
I've been searching. Does Luke write of this? I'm looking through Luke. And
No, I think Matthew... Yeah, Luke does too. Luke, in chapter 8, it says here, right here. Yep. Yeah, in Luke 8. Uh-huh. Yes?
Let me get back to the first part. The faith is what made this woman whole. It wasn't the fact that she touched the hem of Jesus. There were a lot of people there. There must have been at least six others who also their faith made them whole at the time. I mean, they all were there because they had faith. Why else would they be following him? And why were they bumping into him? Or I don't think it was a touch that did it. And there were at least six other men and women that were healed that Mark doesn't talk about. But I'm sure were there in that crowd who were also healed that day. Not necessarily from physical illness, but from faith.
Uh-huh.
But Mark talks about only this one person. How come?
Right. Oh. Well, I think that he picks this one person out because of to make the point that this woman who is an outsider is restored to the inn, and that this is what Jesus' ministry is about.
But he's not saying that there weren't others.
No, and in fact, the whole story, it seems to me, makes it becomes clear that Jesus heals at this end of the spectrum, and Jesus heals at this end of the spectrum, and both happen. You know, the Jairus' daughter is healed, and this outcast woman is healed. Jesus doesn't just heal the outcast. Jesus doesn't just heal the rich. Jesus heals the outcast. It's real interesting that he takes the time. And for those of us who are not on the outcast outside of our society or our church or whatever, it kind of takes us up short to say, well, he takes care of her first. Because essentially it's as if it's saying Jesus takes care of the poor and the outcast before Jesus takes care of me.
Then what do you do with the verse, Jesus shows no partiality?
I have all these.
You mean Peter talks about that.
Yeah.
Well, who's he talking about? He said when Peter says that, what's the context? It's Cornelius. It's Gentiles.
Yeah.
Who are outcasts, who are sinners. They are Gentile sinners. Right? And so Peter it comes to Cornelius and sees that Cornelius and his family have received the Holy Spirit, and Peter goes, "Whoa! Surely God shows no partiality. Even Gentile sinners are getting this." Right? No, but it makes the point, right? That these folks down here, even they're getting it.
Yeah. They're getting it before even the Jews are getting it, who Jesus really is.
Yeah, right.
What about their similarity here with the centurion who talks to Jesus and said his daughter is healed, come and heal her, and he says to him, your faith has made
yeah,
her well.
Yeah. Yeah, when the centurion, he says, you don't even have to come to my house because I'm a man under authority. I give orders and things happen. All you got to do is say the word, right? And Jesus says, of that guy, he says, not even in Israel have I seen such faith, right? This is a Gentile, another Gentile. who does that. And Jesus is, he's floored by that one. He says, whoa.
I think that's because the Jews have so many presuppositions already. They know what to expect, and they can toddle their lives what their beliefs are. And so they're not expecting anything unexpected, whereas somebody outside of that doesn't have any expectations, and so they're wide open for anything to happen.
Yes. And it's not an affliction just of the Jews of the time, but of Christians too today. You know, us good church folk. We've got our expectations, and we know what's right and what will happen and what to expect and what not to expect. Well, that's why there's always the outsider to come in and refresh us. You know? Do you think?
I don't know if it's a tell personal story, but I traveled when I was in college and with a friend in school in Sweden, and we went to St. Peter's in Rome, and we were walking through down towards the main altar, and there were little chapels along the way, and there were caskets along the way with saints. Some of them were glass, and so we stopped by one, and there was a body lying there, and it was a little brown and some, but it was a normal human body. And so we got into a discussion about it and said, oh, we didn't know that anybody mummified people other than the Egyptians. Did the Catholic Church mummify their people? And, a couple behind us who didn't speak English very well just kept saying, no, it's a saint. And we said, well, yes, we know, but how did they do this? It's a saint. But how did they do this in the Catholic? And they just gave up and walked away. It was years later that I found out that some of the saints are incorrupt for hundreds of years, and that's something to do with the spirit working not only in their spirit but in their whole being, and somehow that sometimes causes them to be incorrupted. But our preconceptions didn't fit the circumstance, and you
right.
didn't get it.
Right. Exactly. And that's a little bit like how Jesus must feel when he's talking to the disciples. You know, three times he says, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be handed over, I'm going to be crucified, and on the third day I'm going to rise. All right, Jesus, let's go. We're going. Oh, or else, no, that can't happen to you. And over and over again, he says, no, I'm going to be crucified. And they say, yeah, well... And he said, no, but I'm going to be crucified. But, no, I'm going to be crucified. Yeah, but it's going to be great. You're going to be the king. And no, I'm going to die. And finally, he just gives up. You guys aren't going to get it now. Wait until the Spirit comes, then you'll get it. Yeah, because the idea was, Jesus is going to be the Messiah. He's going to be the new king, the new David, da-da-da-da-da. Which is, I think, why he tells the disciples not to say anything about his being the Messiah. When Peter says, you are the Messiah, Jesus says, don't tell people that. Because they'll get a different notion than what was actually going to happen. So, yeah, our preconceived notions. Other questions yet about the story? No? We're all crystal clear?
Well, I'm noting that, unlike the centurion, Jairus says, come to my house and do this.
Right.
The centurion says, say it. And likewise, the woman, her faith was such that, but he kind of wanted to keep it private. Jairus did.
Oh, you think, Which is maybe why he said, don't tell him, why Jesus might have... If he wanted to keep it private, I wonder if he wanted to keep it owned by him so that...
So
maybe not.
So he would be special?
So what?
So he would be special? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't... I kind of think that's a push. But I do think that Jesus' warning about not telling people does have to do with power and the use of power and the use of this event. That was something that was... kind of became clear last time in the last session this morning that made sense to me, that You keep that to yourself. And then I think about the times when Jesus says, keep that to yourself, as opposed to the times where he says, go out and tell people what God has done for you. It's usually when, as far as I can remember, it's when someone who has been on the outsides is healed or exercised or whatever, that Jesus says, go tell people what God has done for you. So,
you know, the story sounds like such a beautiful sort of healing journey, this sort of parade through the crowd and on the way to, and we have this, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and mm-hmm. there's the vine that's brokenhearted, the lame are made well, the dead are, this portrait picture of Jesus on this healing journey, the kingdom of heaven at hand, along the way, the whole journey is in that little couple stories.
It sure is. Yeah, that's great.
What was the purpose of them asking who touched you? What Jesus asking who touched you?
I think he wanted to know.
Well, I just think that he already would know. Is this a lesson for other people that are there?
Help restore her to community.
It says here that he had felt this healing power going out.
Right.
And so that is amazing to me, that because of the faith this woman had, that this power was just leading him and going to that woman for healing.
Yes.
The feel of that powerful feeling that he has within him.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I think that having felt that power go out and then turning around and asking who, it could be that he was curious about, all right, wow, somebody really has approached me, you know, and but also, and more importantly, I think this is a woman who needs public acclamation. Okay, because otherwise, how are we going to know that this woman is being cleansed and restored?
That she needed that power that he. Only Christ can give to be healed.
To be healed, right. To be healed and to be restored into the community. Again, healing is not just about physical, but it's the whole restoration into it. And that was the way to do it, was publicly proclaiming it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Couldn't just turn around and point his finger at her and say, you touched me. Or something, you know, we wanted to make it more public and point out that, well, she came to him on her knees, you know, and that made it like it wasn't a set up deal.
Right. Yeah, he could have turned around. I mean, conceivably, he could have turned around and you know, if he knew who it was and winked at her. Right. She'd still not have a flow of blood. But that the incredible power of being proclaimed a daughter, huh? You know, that just wouldn't have happened. So I think that's why the whole thing stops.
Yeah, I also assume that Jesus is omniscient or something, and that's not necessarily. That we're just making that assumption.
Yeah.
Which.
That Jesus knows everything.
Right.
Yeah.
That might not necessarily be true.
Yeah.
He might be just a tad bit more normally human.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes.
I'm always being nervous. Not to be too late.
Not to be what?
Too late.
Too late.
As a pastor, many times I was condemned, but you are too late.
Sure.
Jesus was taught, you are too late.
Right.
By Lazarus and Mary and Martha. So the reading of this story, it looks like not to be late. So too late is not.
Too late is not too late.
Not too late.
Yeah.
So what can I think about this possibility? I know Jesus knows everything. Jesus is caring.
Mm-hmm.
But from my side, there is the time, too late. So what can I think? That is my question.
Yeah, oh, that's a good question. The thing that that comes to my mind when you're...
Would you repeat what he said?
He said, obviously for Jesus, too late is not too late. You know? He was too late for Jairus' daughter, but he wasn't too late because she was raised from the dead. But from the perspective of human beings, too late might be too late. Is that your question? And what are we to make of that? In terms of maybe being too late to bring God to somebody, bringing the Spirit to somebody. I when you were talking, I thought of in my old community, people used to always say, God may not get there when you want him, but he's always right on time. Which to me means it may not look like God can do anything with this situation now because things have passed and it's too late. But it's never too late for God. And it also means for me that I have to be humble and say, I'm not the one bringing God. Right? All I'm doing is getting there in order to witness to the fact that God's already there. So God got there a long time before I got there. And so once I get there, my task is not bring God. My task is look around, where is God? Is that helpful?
Yeah. It's helpful.
Yeah.
And so the dynamics of God is operating. Always we are so nervous. We have to do this.
Yes.
We have to.
Yeah.
Then going to be.
Uh-huh.
And forgotten God's operation.
Right. It's as if, oh, you know, we got God here in our pocket, and unless we get there on time, God won't get there. Well, you know, that's obviously ridiculous. As often as I think that way, it's still pretty ridiculous when you think about it.
Even as pastors, just trying to make arrangements to come up here and to be gone for any length of time, we get paranoid. What if something happens? Or if we have someone really ill, what happens if something happens where I'm gone? Oh, maybe I shouldn't go.
Uh-huh.
And we play that mental game. And sometimes, like you said, we just have to let go in knowing that, hey, it's not us, it's God. Sure, we have to be responsible, have someone on call.
Uh-huh.
But God is the one that's going to take care of it. And I think it's really hard for us to let go and to be that.
Yeah, I think that's true.
It really strikes me how much we like to try to put God in some little narrow box that we make for God.
Yeah.
You know, instead of recognizing that, you know, the restorative power of God is oftentimes outside our boundary lines of our expectations or whatever, you know, that we have to start thinking outside of the box too.
Right. And the stories, that these stories are constantly inviting us to do that. It seems to me. Although we resist it greatly. We like the box. Don't you think?
It's comfortable there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really comfortable. Yeah.
One thing that occurs to me is that a lot of people were jostling Jesus in the crowd, and the one with the hemorrhage touched him. Was the one that's healed. Now maybe there were other people healed also, but it gives me the sense that if someone who just bumps into Jesus accidentally isn't going to automatically necessarily be filled with well-being unless he has a need.
Right.
It's her need and willingness to reach out to touch him and his availability to those who have a need and who perceive it and confess it in a sense, reach out with it.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways of, and a lot of different images in Scripture about that, how that works. I mean, as you were talking, my mind went to Peter in Acts when, people who his shadow falls on are healed. You know, it isn't a matter, and we're not told these people are people of great faith who really yearn for healing. Nah, his shadow fell on him, and the Spirit was so strong, boom, just healed him anyway. Yeah. So there's kind of this indiscriminate healing going on. There's also this real intentional stuff going on. It's all over the map in terms of people's seeking it out or not seeking it out, or people's faith or people's not having faith. There's no one way. You can't really nail it down to say you have to have faith, you have to have intention, you have to have all that stuff. You just can't do it finally. But it's fun to have all of them around. I mean, it gets you out of the square that she was talking about, I think. Did you have something?
Yes. The whole feeling that I get from this story is there are many facets to it, but it's all about faith. And it's never too late if you are drawing your last breath and gain your faith. That's the purpose of the whole mission of understanding and believing in God.
Hmm. That it's never too late.
It's never too late.
It's never too late for the thief on the cross who accepted.
Yeah.
He's about as close as you can get, really. The final
man. Yeah. Accepting
your faith.
Yeah. I think so. And that faith also, I think that's true, and I also think it's true, another little bit of faith, of thing on faith, is that faith comes from strange places. Huh? You know, from this destitute woman. She's a profound example of faith, right?
Another, you were talking about his compatriots and how they just didn't seem to get it right.
Uh-huh.
That too was one of the facets of who we are. And we needed that type of following to understand that even we can learn.
Yeah. Yeah, I take comfort in that all the time. Absolutely.
Those are not your footprints in the sand. They're mine. I was carrying them.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Well, Jesus must have gotten tired carrying all 12 of them, though, I tell you. Yeah. Is it, we have a little bit of time, a couple of minutes. Let me ask this. How does it, where do you find yourself in the story? Because I tend to find myself with Jairus. I mean, I want to be with the woman. I really do, because I'm pretty sure that she's the one that you ought to be hanging around with. But what I actually find myself is that I'm really, if I look honestly, I'm with Jairus. You know, I've got some authority, I've got some power, and my sense is, you know, well, it makes me a little uncomfortable that Jesus isn't taking care of me first. Does that strike anybody else as normal or odd or uncomfortable or anything?
No, I think we all do that. I mean, I've been a loyal Christian. I work in the church. I mean, we expect a little better treatment because of that, right?
Sure, sure. But does this story make, if you expect that, does this story make you a little uncomfortable, or does it just kind of say, oh, well, of course I knew that?
Or, well, I think it's a reminder that I don't deserve special treatment. Mm-hmm. That sometimes I may have to wait in line, not in a literal sense, but uh-huh. that God may not answer what I want or when I want. That He has different plans for me.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
I think that sum up what she was talking about. I wouldn't worry about being embarrassed if I were in any, because our rules are not necessarily God's rules. He will do what He will do.
Yep. Obviously, that's true from the story, yes. Yeah, you're right. Someone behind there.
Do you think maybe you identify with Jairus more because you are a father and you can put yourself in his place as one of your kids? I mean, you have a 12-year-old.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, 13.
I know that when I am faced with, like, we had a friend who had a child that died that was the same age as one of our children. Uh-huh. And it really hits home, you know. And so you could probably identify.
Oh yeah, and I know that if I had a kid who was at the point of death, and Jesus was dawdling around with another,
yeah,
with somebody that I didn't know and didn't really care about, I'd be put off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like if you're in front of the line and somebody cuts in.
Right. I was just about to get myself healed, and then this person came in, and I couldn't get it. Right. Yes.
If you're already one of the people with some power, some money, some whatever,
mm-hmm.
Haven't you been in front of the line pretty much most of your life? It's about time somebody in the back line got their share.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that doesn't mean I have to like it.
No. Which shouldn't make you uncomfortable either.
Right. Well, yeah. Yes. No, you're absolutely right. And I think that's... not just this story, but the whole gospel talks. It's like, well, the image of the front of the line. The gospels simply say, "Sorry, folks, the line has been reversed. The last are now first, and we're going that way now instead of this way. And you thought you were first. We thought we were first, and then Jesus says, "Sorry, the line forms." Turns that way, and when you turn that way, then look, you're not in the front anymore, you're at the end.
You know, you should try
ice cream line.
What's that? See, yeah, right.
One time you should just all get in line and then say, "Sorry, we're going to reverse this sucker." Now, what will those people that were standing up in the front of the line
right.
feel?
And they may have even gotten there 15 minutes early to get in the front of the line.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, and isn't that what the gospel says? You know, that the last shall be first and the first shall be last. And this story, I do want to say though, the good news is, it seems to me, in at least from the story of Jairus, of these two stories together, that even the last get raised from the dead.
Going to say, is that how the scribes and Pharisees felt? You know, they thought they were living in the law of God.
Good friends
all
of mine.
Of a sudden they're...
Yes, that's exactly how we feel. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Are there other... I'm sorry. Oh, tomorrow. Thank you very much. Genesis 38. Rated R, but I think we can handle it.
Let's make sure we read it.
Well, thank you very much.